The future of state insurance exchanges, a look inside the mysterious economics of IKEA and football, obviously. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In San Francisco, I'm Molly Wood, sitting in for Kai Rizdahl. It is Thursday, November 24th. Happy Thanksgiving, and thanks to you for being with us today and every day. A little news appetizer to start us off. Repeal and replace may be the Republican battle cry about Obamacare right now, but in some states, there's more interest in strengthening it than in tearing it down. See, in most places, the feds operate the insurance exchanges where consumers can shop for federally subsidized health care plans. But 11 U.S. states and Washington, D.C. operate their own. With their future in doubt, Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein looks at what would be lost and potentially gained if these sites go away.
President-elect Trump says he wants free market solutions to make care more affordable. Check and check, says Peter Lee, the head of the state exchange covered California.
Forget the label of Obamacare. We have competing private health plans that are fighting over getting enrollment where consumers are the ones that are making choices.
California's exchange is often held up as the shining example of Obamacare that works. Even this year's 13% premium hike fell well short of the national average increase at 22%. Larry Levitt with the Kaiser Family Foundation says exchanges at their best have lots of competition and have made buying coverage easier than it's ever been.
The states that have done well under Obamacare have been proactive in implementing it and made policy decisions to make the law work.
But no matter how well some exchanges work, they depend on federal subsidies. And if Obamacare is gutted, that money goes with it. And states probably can't afford the billions it would cost to do this on their own. Kathy Hempstead with the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation says, though, there are reasons to consider alternatives to the exchanges. Today, nearly half of the individual market, some 10 million consumers, buy coverage off of the exchanges and don't get the consumer handholding and other benefits.
I've always felt like this was sort of a regrettable feature of the way the market's set up right now is that, you know, half of the market has a much better shopping experience than the other half.
Hempstead says eliminating exchanges and having regulated brokers sell subsidized plans could save money. The trade-off, though, could be losing consumer-friendly features like call centers that have helped demystify one of the most perplexing products around. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
Time for football? Yeah, let's do it. Here's some trivia. The National Football League has been playing games on Thanksgiving since 1920, but you could say the Detroit Lions were the first team to really embrace the Thanksgiving Day game. The Lions have played on Thanksgiving since 1934, and they won today. And in 1966, the Dallas Cowboys got on board, so you had two games during which to ignore the relatives. Now you can yell at the TV all the way through the turkey and well into primetime. Marketplace's Andy Euler looks at how Thanksgiving football became an all-day event and a money-minting machine for the NFL.
Back in 1934, pro football wasn't really a thing. American sports fans were into baseball, but there's no baseball on Thanksgiving, and Detroit Lions owner G.A. Richards figured people were off work, so they might buy a ticket to come out to watch his Lions play. But he was just trying to sell tickets. That worked for a while.
I think they realized early that game day attendance was not going to be the revenue driver, that it was going to be TV.
That's John Vrooman. He teaches sports economics at Vanderbilt.
The NFL and TV have co-evolved. Like when TV kind of took off, particularly color television, when it took off in the 60s, then the NFL's right there with it.
He says in 1966, when the league was looking for a second game on Thanksgiving, Dallas Cowboys general manager Tex Schramm figured TV would boost the team's exposure. Michael McCambridge is author of America's Game, the epic story of how pro football captured a nation.
American families get together on holidays and because of that need distractions. And the NFL is one of our most reliable holiday distractions.
And that reliability has made the NFL a lot of money. Broadcast rights for the NFL games are among the most expensive in all of TV. Ad rates are really high, too. When the Cowboys and Carolina Panthers met last Thanksgiving, it was the most watched regular season game all year. There are games in primetime now, too.
Do your relatives leave at 6 o'clock or do they stay longer? I think there was a void there in primetime. I think the NFL recognized that there was a very fertile, captive viewing audience there.
an audience probably tuning in to watch the Pittsburgh Steelers take on the Indianapolis Colts. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
On Wall Street, markets are closed today, but international markets and U.S. futures are all trending up. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Okay, we've had appetizers and we moved on to football. It's pretty clear this is couch time. Hey, but consider the couch or chair or coffee table for a second. In quite a lot of houses, including mine, there's a decent chance at least some of those things came from the yellow and blue juggernaut of the furniture world. Yeah, I'm talking about IKEA. I am. And it turns out IKEA is actually a bit of an economic enigma. But whatever it's doing, it's working. Oliver Rader is a senior writer for 538. He wrote a piece titled The Weird Economics of IKEA. Oliver, how are you?
Hi, I'm well, thanks.
All right, so let's talk about, let's get down to business. First of all, we have to talk about the sheer size of IKEA. And I don't mean each individual store, which itself is overwhelming. But you said in your piece that IKEA uses up to 1% of the planet's lumber. Is that every year?
That's right. Each year, according to the company, they use 1% of all the wood we use to make things, and that adds up to hundreds of millions of cubic feet of wood every single year. It's just incredible.
Yeah, and it seems to be beyond just scale in some ways. Can you talk a little bit about, you illustrated some of these interesting economics with the Poang chair. I don't know if I'm saying that correctly, although I do own one.
Well, I'm not fluent in Swedish, but I think that's right. The Poang chair was designed about 40 years ago, and it's one of IKEA's best-selling products. They sell about 1.5 million every single year. And I was watching an old movie, an 80s movie, and I saw what I thought was the chair. So being, you know, the data journalist that I am, I had to go look up old IKEA catalogs and see how much this thing would have cost. And IKEA came to the U.S. in 1985. And by around 1990, if you adjust for inflation, the Poang chair cost about $350 in 1990. And today, you can get the chair for less than $80. So this was kind of my data jumping off point for the piece. It was just that remarkable decline in price.
I think I paid like about $125. So I was probably right in the middle of that curve of my Poang chair buying. But so how is it that IKEA is consistently able to lower the relative price of some, if not all, of its products?
It turned out that an economist had actually looked at these trends a bit, Marian Baxter, who's at Boston University. So I chatted with her, and she had been working on a project basically encoding IKEA catalogs back decades. And her theory is almost Darwinian, the idea being that IKEA will introduce a product, say the Poang chair, and then if it does well, it'll be sort of a survival of the fittest. So they'll figure out how to make them more efficiently, and if economies of scale really kick in, that's why we see the price kind of go down down over time.
Yeah. Tell me about the expensive products. What happens to them?
So the opposite is also true, but it's a little bit harder to see in the data, of course, because those products just disappear. So if they introduce a product that is finicky to make, maybe it requires parts from one country and other parts from another and design in a third, and it doesn't sell well at its initial price, that product will basically disappear from the catalog.
How does the catalog play into it?
Every year they put out a catalog, and you can find, nowadays, you can find a PDF of that catalog online. It's not exhaustive. It's not every single product. But for my piece and for Baxter's economic research, it was a wonderful source of data, basically. So I started just by Googling, you know, IKEA catalog 1985, and you can even find pages from, you know, 30-year-old IKEA catalogs, and they print the price right in the catalog. So for a data journalist or for an economist, they turned out to be, you know, very data-rich historical documents.
And clearly, and you even say this, IKEA is in a class by itself. What are they so good at? What are the pieces you think that let them dominate the furniture space for so long?
There are no other IKEAs. Marian Baxter, the economist, told me that, you know, 15 years ago, she would have told you there would have been IKEAs all over the place. And she would have been dead wrong. And yeah, there are some other kind of interesting mysteries too from an economic point of view. One is kind of international pricing discrepancies. So occasionally a price of a piece will go up in Canada but down in the U.S., which, if you can believe it, well, you know, even makes Canadians mad, which is a pretty horrifying prospect. There are unanswered IKEA mysteries out there. If a budding young economist is looking for a thesis topic, there you go.
I think it's got to be the meatballs. It's got to be.
Must be the meatballs.
Oliver Rader is a senior writer for 538. Thanks so much for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
All right, let's milk this device a little longer. We have moved on to couch time, which means we're that much closer to holiday shopping time. So let's do some history once again. Lots of our American Christmas traditions were actually established during World War II. Back then, a fair number of the traditions revolved around scarcity and hope for better days. Design historian Sarah Archer explores Christmas time during the war as well as post-war in her new book, Mid-Century Christmas. And today she's kicking off our series, Holidays, brought to you by
Imagination.
Wonderful products.
Brought to you by...
The traditional Christmas wish for peace on Earth was especially poignant during World War II, when so many American families had loved ones overseas. The war effort and the home front included rationing, which meant that shoppers could purchase only small amounts of grocery staples like meat, dairy, coffee, sugar, canned goods. Materials like rubber, metal, and gasoline were rationed too. Americans were encouraged to quote-unquote make do and mend, conserve energy at home and in the car, tailor clothing to use as little fabric as possible, and recycle or reuse household goods and materials. Coming as it did on the heels of the Great Depression, though, this kind of household thrift was already familiar to most Americans, and indeed, many felt proud to be doing their part in helping the war effort. Rationing meant scaling way back on all the things that had been associated with Christmas since the mid-19th century. Food and drink, material goods, decorative lights, even the use of the telephone for making long-distance calls. The bittersweet experience of wartime Christmas in America was captured by hit songs like Bing Crosby's I'll Be Home for Christmas, written for troops in 1943.
I'll be home for Christmas.
And Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas from the 1944 movie musical Meet Me in St. Louis.
Have yourself a merry little Christmas.
In the movie, Judy Garland is costumed to look like a Gilded Age teenager in turn-of-the-century Missouri. But when she sang,
"Next year all our troubles will be out of sight,"
wartime listeners and moviegoers understood what she meant. Americans were encouraged by the Office of War Information and, curiously, by corporations to do without things and to spend their money on war bonds instead of gifts.
It's Mother's Christmas present.
War bond.
Yes, darling. War bond.
Well, gee, thanks a lot, Mom, but I wanted a bicycle.
Some companies capitalized on this by offering products in tandem with the purchase of war bonds and used its paid ad space to share tips on how readers could make their homes, quote, war-shortening households by conserving and reusing materials. After the war, companies that made materials that had previously been rationed, like Reynolds Metals, who made aluminum foil, or DuPont, who made cellophane, began advertising ways to use these new materials in do-it-yourself holiday decorating projects. And the magazines followed suit, carrying on an inventive wartime tradition in the era of post-war abundance.
That was Sarah Archer, author of Mid-Century Christmas. Coming up.
So a primary goal is to increase families' access to enough food that provides adequate nutrition.
A farm that helps families that are vulnerable to addiction and food insecurity. But first, let's do the numbers. Our stock exchanges are closed, but foreign traders had a busy day. Britain's FTSE added a 0.1%, the German DAX picked up 0.25%, and France's CAC 40 ended the day 0.3% higher. But enough business. Let's talk turkey. 45 million turkeys will be on the table today. 276 million of us will be at the table today. And the national tab for turkey alone will be over $1 billion. Some other numbers worth remembering. 45 million people in this country live in households that don't have enough food to eat. 13 million of them are children. 25% of military families have trouble putting food on the table. And as of 2010, nearly one-third of our retail food supply was wasted. Seems like we can do better. You're listening to Marketplace.
Coming up this season on Codebreaker, do you think that this technology has saved you?
I'm probably alive because of it, but I don't know. I think it's probably saved me physically, but I think spiritually it probably bankrupted me.
We are back with a second season and a new question. Can it save us? We're asking this question of a different kind of technology every week. Subscribe now on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Listen, decode, and decide.
This is Marketplace. I'm Molly Wood. When we left you before the break, we were talking holiday traditions and shopping. But I get it. Maybe you're not ready to start just yet. Maybe you're all about the last-minute gift or just the easy flexibility that comes with a gift card. The best and simplest present of them all, until it's not. David Lazarus is a business columnist at the Los Angeles Times who recently wrote about gift card fraud. How are you, David?
I'm good, thank you.
All right, so we are gearing up for the holiday shopping. I know that I, among millions of others, will be purchasing the last-minute gift card. And you wrote about some potential pitfalls there. What happened to this couple, the Polans, who reached out to you?
Well, the Polans went to a CVS, and they wanted to give cards to their daughter. And so they plunked down $1,000 for Nordstrom. It's like an expensive gift.
No warning bells here, really. CVS, Nordstrom, these are all known entities.
All brand names. You would think that there's nothing to worry about. And so they go to the cashier, they activate the cards, take the cards, give the cards to the daughter. Daughter goes to Nordstrom, and the cards are empty. Okay, that's a problem.
Yeah.
So then the Polans go back to first CVS. CVS says, no, we activated them. Not our problem. So then they go to Nordstrom. Nordstrom says, well, they weren't activated as far as we're concerned. Not our problem. And suddenly you've got $1,000 that's unaccounted for.
So how did these companies deal with this? What did Nordstrom do? And most importantly, did these people get their money back?
Well, they did get their money back, but it took some arm twisting. They had to come to me first, and then I was able to lean on the companies to actually investigate the problem. And then when they did, what do you know? It turns out that, yeah, it was activated, but then some sort of fraud took place at some point, and the money went missing. I think what a lot of people don't realize is there is, in fact, a shadowy world of third parties out there that handle the actual activation of the card. And they're not really accountable to anybody because we just don't know who they are. I'm not saying that's where the fraud took place because Nordstrom or CVS wouldn't tell me that, but it looks a little suspicious that that's where it seems like the money has gone. And if that's the case here, it makes you wonder how often this happens.
Yeah, absolutely. And how common do you think and how many different ways can scammers pull off fraud like this?
It is very common, and that's something that I really need to emphasize for people because gift cards are one of the single most popular and ubiquitous gifts at this time of year. And so what you need to remember are there are various ways that they can be scammed. For example, one of the most common is a fraudster will go into the CVS or the Walgreens or the whatever and find gift cards just loose on the rack. They can then write down the numbers of these cards, and then they're able to go online, track the numbers, wait for them to be activated, and jump on them.
Wow.
And then as if that wasn't bad enough, there have been reports of cashiers during the activation phase using small scanners to swipe the card, and then they either have the number or they're going to keep the active card and give you a blank and send you on your way.
Wow.
And that happens as well.
So this is a giant buzzkill for the holidays. what you alluded to some tips earlier. How should you buy? I mean, it's clear that they are so popular that they are a juicy target. What's the right way to buy them? Because if I can't go to 7-Eleven and get my last minute gift card, what am I going to do?
The thing to do in a situation like this is you buy the gift card from the actual merchant. Also, as I said before, be very careful of cards that are loose in the rack. That's always a thing. And then when you do buy the card, it's perfectly okay for you then to turn to the cashier and say, let's confirm that.
And are there any attempts that you have heard of to crack down on this kind of fraud as it gets more common?
While the authorities know about it, as with most cases of fraud and identity theft, it's one of those things where even though everyone wrings their hands about it, it's a tough one to prosecute. I mean, here's a scary number to keep in mind. When it comes to identity theft, the actual number of prosecutions and convictions, 1%.
Wow. That's David Lazarus, business columnist at the LA Times, here to ruin Christmas. Thanks so much.
Ho, ho, ho.
In among the eating and the shopping, it's easy to forget the holidays are also a time for real giving, for trying to do a little good in the world. Here's a story about that. Medford in Southern Oregon has such a problem with crystal meth production and abuse that people actually call it Methford. It is devastating, and one of the problems that comes along with drug addiction is child abuse and neglect. To combat that, the local family nurturing center started a program called the Farm and Food Program. It brings together families that are vulnerable to addiction, neglect, and a lack of food, and it gets them dirty in the field. Melanie Savchenko visited the farm and sent this report.
Mary Strock turns the crank of a corn sheller. The blue kernels from the cob fall into a wooden box. Later, they'll be milled and baked into cornbread. This is one of the central activities at the Farm and Food Program, because families can participate in the full cycle of the heirloom corn, from harvesting to eating. Here's Strock.
I'm learning a bunch about organic gardening, and I love just being outside in the sunshine and doing hard, you know, manual work. It feels good on my body and my soul, my spirit.
As a mother of three, Strock struggled with heroin addiction. Last year, she was enrolled in a residential treatment program called OnTrack in Medford. For 5 years now, dads and moms, like Mary Strock, have been coming to the Farm and Food Program at Hanley Farm. On a weekly basis, they volunteer in the gardens, learn about nutritious food, and gain parenting skills. Strock is now employed as a peer mentor to support the other mothers in the program.
That's a huge part of recovery, is learning how to give back and get out of the self-centeredness. And it feels really good when you start to find ways to do that.
Doug Loftall, who works at the Family Nurturing Center, created the Farm and Food Program to give people with addiction access to activities and resources that weren't available to them.
We tried to frame this program so that it's not about treating people with a diagnosis, but we're thinking of those diagnoses really as symptoms of things that are lacking in our community.
One of the things that can be lacking is food. According to a 2014 report from the U.S. Department of Agriculture, Oregon is among the nation's hungriest states. Here's Kristen Gallibrun, who co-manages the program with Loftall.
So a primary goal is to increase families' access to enough food that provides adequate nutrition.
That's crucial for child development, said Philip Yates of Access, a nonprofit that provides food and housing to low-income families.
So I think the programs that the Family Nurturing Center are offering really help to address those issues early on and give the families a sense of stability and knowledge of what kind of things are important for them to eat that will make them healthy and their kids as well.
And a healthy diet improves emotional well-being, which, Gallibrun says,
affects our relationships with ourselves, with our kids, with our families, with our communities, and with the environment.
Rocky Wales has been a heroin addict for years. He was enrolled in OnTrack's Dad's program this summer, which meets once a week on the farm for 3 hours of volunteer work. His wife was in the Mom's program. During weekly family groups on the farm, parents get to reunite with their kids, cook meals from the food they harvest, and support each other's families.
It's just an atmosphere where everybody wants to get clean. They want to live a better life. They want to be there for their children and just break that cycle, basically.
In the fields,
and we've got corn going here.
Doug Loftall shows us the vegetable beds.
Squash.
The idea is to maintain a simple no-till grow space, something families can make at home. For Rocky Wales, the farm creates a community.
It just keeps you away from the scene and the chaos of everyday life where people go back and relapse. And if you ever get to that point, you got to stay connected.
Wales and his wife are now in outpatient treatment. They live together in a house with their two kids. In Central Point, Oregon, I'm Melanie Savchenko for Marketplace.
And this final note before we go, speaking of Thanksgiving, a sort of sad irony is playing out on a Native American reservation in North Dakota. Hundreds of protesters are camped out in freezing weather in a standoff over the $3.7 billion Dakota Access Pipeline. Construction is mostly stopped while the Army Corps of Engineers looks at the impact of further building. But the tribes say the project has already destroyed sacred burial grounds and threatens the water supply at the Standing Rock Sioux Reservation. In the last 2 weeks, clashes with protesters and police have intensified. There have been multiple injuries, dozens of arrests, and allegations of human rights abuses. State leaders sent a letter yesterday asking President Obama to approve further work. Tribal leaders want him to stop the pipeline and force it to be rerouted. In early November, President Obama called the situation challenging and said it could play out for a couple more weeks. All right, we got to go. John Buckley, Deirdre Depke, Eve Epstein, George Judson, Suzanne Levy, Andrea Seabrook, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. Our interim managing editor is John Gordon. I am Molly Wood. We'll see you tomorrow, everyone, and happy Thanksgiving. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.